Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our first quarter equity overview. I'm being joined by Chuck Gibson, who is my partner in C-Lane Advisory and the managing member of both Financial Perspectives and C-Lane Advisory in the San Francisco Bay Area. We've had quite a year in the equity markets. We're going to talk a little bit about how the markets have been performing since our equity overview in the fourth quarter, and then the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the bond market, and what we can possibly expect in the bond market this year and what it's going to mean to equity. So, Chuck, that's a lot to cover. So thank you for joining us on this O'Leary Report.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Catherine.
Okay, well, bring us up to date on the equity markets. Tell us how things have been for the last quarter.
Okay, so a couple things. One is I do want to split this into two sections. In the first section, as you said, we're just going to talk briefly about, not just about how they did in the fourth quarter, but I wanted to just do a quick recap of 2013.
Okay, great.
Okay, so in essence, 2013 really can be summarized as an exceptionally strong one for the U.S. stock market investors. You know, big gains were realized in this fifth year of the current cyclical bull market that we're in. Earlier this year, I blogged about the possibility of a really banner year this year based upon the January barometer. And For those who don't know, that the January barometer is a metric that we use that state, as January goes, so goes the rest of the year. And if you look back, January in 2013 had an unbelievable month. It was up more than 5%. So it's really not unexpected that 2013 overall turned out to be as good as it was.
Well, it surprised me.
Well, the other thing that was really surprising was the fact that it turned out to be the fact that it came with such little volatility. And if you look at chart number one, what I have here is just kind of a representation of that. So what this is this chart depicts the S&P 500 price movement from the 2009 bear market bottom to the end of 2013, and it highlights the market swings in prices, identifying both percentages gained or lost and the time that it took to complete those swings, both in trading and calendar day. So it's a little bit complicated, and there's a lot of data there. You can see also that the increases are labeled in green and the drawdowns are labeled in red. So, for example, and just to get a bearing here, the correction that we saw that started in May of 2011, the market fell 21.58% and lasted 108 trading days. So now that we have that as a reference point, what I wanted to really point out in this chart is that the worst decline that we experienced during the entire 2013 was just a 7.52% decline, and it lasted only 22 days.
Right.
And this, to me, is just an unbelievable level of investor complacency I've never seen before.
Right. To a certain extent, if you look at what happened in the general trend up, this is what investors want. I call it the stairway to heaven. everything goes up a little bit every day forever.
Yes. Right. There's very little that you have to worry about because it doesn't fall very far.
Right.
So, while 2013 was really good to U.S. stock investors, not every region in the world fared quite as well. And that's really clearly identified in chart number two.
Right.
So this chart is a list of the major world regional stock exchanges and their respective 2013 returns. And I think a quote from Yogi Berra comes to mind. It says, it's like deja vu all over again, because 2013 looks almost exactly like 2012 did. We saw the emerging markets were weak, and we saw that the developed country stock markets that could benefit from central bank intervention really did.
Right. So it's impossible to tell how central bank intervention related, but needless to say, there was no doubt that there was significant central bank intervention in Japan and Europe and the United States. So it's hard not to posit that had a profound impact.
Yeah, and if you look a little bit, if you look at the two final columns, the second to last column is the percent change in the stock market for the year, and the final column on the right is the percent change in the stock market over annualized over the last 3 years. Right. And interestingly enough, if you look at the big winner was Venezuela.
And so Venezuela was up 480% in 2013.
Exactly. Yes. So you kind of wonder whether or not their central bank intervention had anything to do with their stock market success, too. All right. With that in mind, let's switch to chart number three, which is my favorite chart in total of all the ones I'm presenting tonight. And this is a chart of how U.S. equity, or excuse me, how equity returns across the various regions were composed. So what it does is it breaks it down by dividends, which are in dark blue, PE expansion, which is in light blue, and then the earnings per share change, which is in light green. And if you kind of start at the left side there and you look at Japan, you can see that their 50% plus stock return was due mostly to actual earnings per share increases, unlike the United States, which I thought was, you know, would be much stronger than that, where actually the majority of our gains were due to expansion of the price-to-earnings ratio.
Right. So with that, for those who don't know what a price-earnings ratio is, that's the relationship between the value of the stock and the earnings. So if a company makes a dollar per share and the stock is $10, then it's trading at a 10 PE. And when you have an expansion of price-earnings ratios, it's simply the valuation, you know, some would argue it's inflation. But essentially, the company's cost of capital is dropping dramatically. So for the same amount of earnings, they're getting a much higher valuation on their stock. And that is a very big expansion in 1 year.
Oh,
it's pretty significant. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And you see in bull markets, the price-earnings ratio continues to expand, and in bear markets, you see that it contracts dramatically. So go compare this against the 2008-2009 drop, and you'll see, you know, where we're probably 100% above in price-earnings ratio where we were back then.
Well, I think right now we're, you know, if you look at the chart of historically where we've been in the S&P, we're relatively, you know, we're not at the peak, but we're relatively high. And as you see more and more managers saying, you know, the U.S. market is fully valued, that's what they're talking about, is the relative PE to historical PEs.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
You know, and the other thing that's interesting about this chart, I thought, was, is, you know, if you look to the two columns all the way on the right there, you've got Asia ex Japan and the emerging markets. And both of those, as you can see, didn't do very well. But they tended to be, if you look at how their returns were broken out, they tended to be a lot more balanced than were either Japan, United States, or Europe.
So it's quite remarkable, because if you look at the areas of the world that have real fundamental growth, they're the ones that had no growth in earnings and no price earnings multiple expansion.
I know.
So it's kind of, you know, the more they're growing, the worse they did.
Yeah, the fundamental disconnect.
Yeah.
All right, that's it for chart number three. And then the last chart is a snapshot of the United States returns by sector. And what really surprised me in this chart was that less than half of the sectors, and these are sectors as defined by stock charts, there are a few others that aren't included here, but less than half the sectors were positive for the year. So what it was telling me, and this was a complete surprise, is that the, you know, the 30%+ gains was really not as broad-based as I had thought. And really, it was only healthcare, the industrials, financials, and the consumer cyclicals that were the year's winners.
Right. Right. So we have the sectors that were down for the year overall are it's technology, materials, energy, consumer staples, and utilities.
Yeah.
So you had a lot, you know, it was, I don't know, sometimes it was very hard to, you know, watch particular stocks and then look and everybody say the market's going up and you're saying, well, there are big parts of it that are not, they're going down. It was very, you know, it was very divergent. It was very divergent. And I think it was, you know, one of my favorite quotes from the year was Hugh Hendry is a hedge fund manager in Europe who finally said, you know, I give up, this market has nothing to do with fundamentals. You just have to invest in the trend. So, but it was very hard to equate fundamentals to what was happening. And I think you see that when you look at the price earnings expansion.
Yeah, so. It seemed like at some point in time during the year, almost all the bears threw in the towel and just decided to ride the wave.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, really that's it that I have for the wrap-up for 2013. I just wanted to do a quick overview. So now that we're, you know, firmly entrenched January in this new year, I thought it would be worthwhile to look at those major drivers that I think are going to have the greatest impact to the equity returns this year, and then spend the balance of today's report talking about them.
Okay.
All right. And for me, I didn't have to think real hard or very long about this. And in my opinion, it's two things. It's one is interest rates, and the other are corporate earnings.
Right.
So, you know, there are other things that are in there, and the one, you know, but I think these are the two greatest. And I also wanted to just make sure that, you know, this discussion is going to ignore any and all exogenous stock shocks that we're going to have potentially to the market. So, for example, this isn't what I'm predicting, but I'm just saying, if we have a war, that would be a shock to the market that would just potentially throw all interest rates and corporate earnings, you know, out the window and take over.
Right. And especially when you have price earnings, you know, PEs that are very relatively high.
Yes.
All you need is an event like that to cut them significantly, and you get very big shifts.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's always the thing. You know, when you're reasonably priced or fairly priced, and, you know, that's obviously a subjective term, when you have those shocks, you tend to have much more muted responses to that. But the further you are in expanding your PDEs, the greater the response it's going to happen if you have one.
Right.
So as you said, you know, I think it that interest rates are really the 900-pound gorilla in the equity party room. And I hope you don't mind. I'm going to spend a little bit of time going over some real basic stuff because I'm not sure how much the listeners are going to understand about the market. So I'm going to touch on it real briefly. And for those that understand, I apologize for getting so simple, but I think it's good to have a reasonable foundation for this discussion.
Just go.
Okay. All right, so first thing I would just want to talk about what bonds are. So quickly, bonds are just a debt investment in which an investor loans money to an entity, you know, like a corporation or a government, and who borrows those money for a defined period of time and at a fixed interest rate, not always fixed, but at an interest rate. And bonds are used by companies and governments to finance a variety of projects and activities, right? So holding a bond gives the owner a stream of cash payments, which is your interest, and, you know, at a defined period. And in the future, it also, if everything works as it was contracted, then the return of principal at maturity. And investors really own them to provide an income stream and or diversification against stock holdings or those risky assets. So that's just a quick summary on bonds.
Okay.
Okay, so let's take a look. We did this before, I don't know, was it about a year ago? We looked at the bond market. And so let's take a look at the world bond market. And so the bond market globally has been estimated to be approximately $100 trillion.
And that's just bonds and fixed income. It doesn't include derivatives.
Correct. Correct. Right. Thank you for bringing that up. And if you look at that on a GDP basis, just for normalization purposes, it's roughly 140% of the total world's gross domestic product. Now, interestingly enough, that is up 80%, meaning it's increased 80% since 2008. And
so in 2008, it was?
Let's see, 80, it was?
Less than it was less than 1 year's GNP.
It was about 80 trillion. Yes, it was less. Yes, it was about 80 trillion.
Yeah.
Or excuse me.
Okay.
60 trillion. Did that work out? Yeah.
Wow. So it's exploded.
Yeah, and but you know, I mean, again, it's much easier to grasp and get our arms around the United States debt because it's, you know, a lot more open, but you know, the Bureau of International Settlements did a recent recount and have found multiple areas of the original $100 trillion estimate, and they found some areas of double counting. So their estimate is closer to $80 trillion, but, you know, $80 trillion, $100 trillion, that's with a T. What's the difference in my mind?
Well, I remember in 2005, the Financial Times came out with a covering a report. It turned out that foreigners said the United States owed it $2.3 trillion more than the United States said is owed. So there, you know, there's all sorts of games going on in the books around this. But the reality is, if you look at how much particularly sovereign governments owe in the developed world, it's grown tremendously since the bailouts.
Absolutely. And if you go to my next chart, which is chart number 5, you can see on all global bonds how the debt is denominated. So in this case, roughly 70% of the debt around the world is denominated in U.S. dollars.
Right. And what we've got now, because interest rates have been coming down as this has been happening, what we've got now is a whole world of issuers, including many sovereign governments in the developed world, who are basically financing themselves by providing savers with no returns whatsoever because interest rates are so low.
Absolutely.
And, of course, one of the reasons this is such a big question for us in the equity markets is, you know, how is this going to possibly continue? And if it changes, what is that going to mean to the equity markets?
Right. Right. Well, bringing that up, if you go to chart number 6, which is total debt by sector, and sector, you can see that roughly 50% of all the debt you talked about governments is government-related debt. And 39% is financial, and, of course, then the balance of that is only 12%.
Right, and something very few people realize is that so much of the government borrowing financed government expenditures that directly or indirectly generate corporate earnings. So corporate earnings have been tremendously blessed by governments being able to access huge amounts of money in the fixed income markets.
Yes. And I talk a little bit about that later on when we talk about market analysis. So, but it's good to reemphasize that because that is part of the reason how much I'm not quite sure I have a handle on. Maybe you can give me your input. How much do you think of corporate earnings today are driven because of that rather than efficiencies or share buybacks or things like that?
Right.
Let's see. We've kind of did a quick overview of the global market. Let's take a look at the United States market. A little bit better and more refined data here. So if you look at chart number 7, this is the U.S. bond market by type. And so you can see, well, I'll summarize it here. Roughly 45% of the debt as issued in the United States is governmental debt, either federal or state or municipality. 24% is from corporations, and then closely followed by mortgage debt at 21%. I thought that was interesting. I didn't realize
that is interesting.
It was that high.
I bet it's come down.
Yeah, well, I would have thought so. I remember back in 2008 or 9 when we were at that peak of the subprime crisis, it was, you know, in the low single digit or double digits.
Yeah. I bet it's come down.
Okay. So let's see. Let's move on to chart number 8. So I was looking for a chart that shows the comparison of the bond market to the stock market size. And while it's not exactly what I wanted, it does a pretty good job here. What this is this gives us a view back from 1988 until 2012, and it's normalized by GDP. So what jumps out at me is noticing that, you know, the stock market peak during the IPO craze in the 1990s and has since been really on a decline. And you can see where we're at today, whereas the bond market has done just the opposite, and it's been on a steady rise except for, you know, it peaked in 2010 there and has a slight decline into 2012.
Yeah, you know, every time I look at charts like these, I feel like saying, you know, sometimes I can be very repetitive on the Solari report, and I just have to be very repetitive again. Many of us have lived in a world where the bond market is just providing enormous amounts of money very, very cheaply. Yep. You know, we've never lived in a world where that was reversing. And And of course, we've lived in a world where if we're saving, you know, if we're putting money into pension funds or Social Security, you know, we're giving cash to the system. And so we've been giving cash to the system in a world where debt is and money's cheap. But we're coming into a world where suddenly we're going to ask for it back just as that cheap money is going away. And that's a double whammy in terms of the, you know, sort of in a way that's going to affect the culture in a very deep way. And I always struggle with how to explain to people what an enormous change in behavior that something like this can cause throughout the government and throughout society.
And I think back to the days of when we had, you know, double-digit interest rates and you know, the changes and the things that you had to deal with at that point in time where we, you know, and I don't think a whole lot of people have experienced that, gone through that.
Right.
It's almost, you know, it's going to be a culture shock if we get to that point.
It's a real shock, yeah, because we're going from a world where we're capitalist cheap to capitalist dear.
Yeah. Although, the one thing before I move on to the next, I thought was, you know, just to try and capture here was that if you look, the bond market in the United States as of 2012 was about 2 times the size of the stock market. And, you know, from I went back and looked at the data and then that I had from before, and I believe that in general that's a pretty good valuation for not just the United States but also around the world. The bond markets tend to be between two and three times. It's always in flux, but it's somewhere between 2 and 3 times in the global market too.
Well, when I look at this chart, I say, this is a society that needs to do a debt for equity swap. And whenever I say that, everybody says, what in the world are you talking about?
And that may be the only solution that there is to get out of this problem, you know, all the things that you just talked about.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So, all right. Regular listeners, I don't know if there are any, should be familiar with this chart, which is number 9. As this, you know, we've gone to this chart many times before, and this is one that we watch very closely because it signals, well, it doesn't signal, it holds the signals as to when we think, you know, that this 2-decade-long bull market might, I want to emphasize, might be coming to an end. I'm not saying that it is, I'm just saying this is what we're looking for. You know, we watch closely to look for those signals. And for those not familiar seeing it, you know, I'm not familiar or actually seeing it for the first time. This is a chart of the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond price over the past 20 years.
So this is the price, not the yields.
This is the price, not the yield. And I'm going to confuse you even later when I'm going to bring up the yield chart. So anyway,
okay.
The point here is that I've highlighted areas in pink there that show where we have gone through corrections. And so I include not only the size of the decline, but also the length or the time that it took to go through that. And so if you look at where we are today, we've currently fallen 17% from the top, and it's taken 76 weeks, or 17 months. And, you know, that's one of the largest declines and time periods that we've experienced during this whole 20-year uptick.
Right, so it started in the middle of 2012?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. One thing I do want to point out before I move on, if you look at the top pane up above, that's the RSI, which is a momentum indicator, and you notice that where we are right now, there's a red line that I've marked. And what this is showing is that we have divergence in price and momentum. And so what this says is that the momentum is actually moving up, so bond prices are actually moving down, so there's the divergence. And that doesn't come very often. If you look to the left on the RSI, I've identified 3 other time periods where we had that same divergence. And if you look when that happened and what happened afterwards, you can see that there were subsequent rallies in the bond market. So while I am not predicting anything here, I would just say that, you know, this is while we're getting close to the bottom of the channel and we're very concerned about breaking down below that channel, we do have one thing that's in our favor if we're concerned about higher bond yields. And that is that we have the divergence helping us out here.
Well, it's clearly the historical pattern has been we should, you know, you would think you would get a rally here.
Yep.
But I will say this, if it does break down through the bottom trend line, you're going to see a lot of fear in the markets.
Yeah, you know, this is not something that there aren't a whole lot of people, or there are a whole lot of people that are watching this. So the problem is that people know this, and if and when you do get that break, people are going to take the same actions that, you know, that we're looking at. And what that does is that tends to create, you know, the lemming effect, where a whole bunch of people are moving in the same direction, and you just get a very, potentially very large, you know, movement, way more than you would be normally.
Right, and let me just describe what the pain is. If you look at, because this is not unrelated to a lot of the discussion we've had on the Salary Report over the last year about pension funds. In 2013, if you had bought a 30-year bond fund, treasuries, at the beginning of the year, you'd probably be down by the end of the year. You would have lost 10 to 15% of your principal.
Yep.
And it's not like you were getting a good yield on the thing in the first place. Okay, so you were getting hardly any yield, but then to turn around and lose 10 to 15% of your principal on something that's supposed to be the safest thing in the world, that's pretty scary. So if you're already, you know, so you have an entire world of investors, and I think pension funds are, to me, one of the most important ones systemically, you know, who've been, as their paper matures, they've been losing their high interest rate stuff. They've been reinvesting in things that are not producing much of a yield, and now they're at risk of losing principal. So to me, if you get a real breakdown, then I think, you know, people have a real reason to run. So it could be very painful if we break that line.
Correct. And that leads me into my, you know, my next discussion about the Fed. I really, you know, again, I just don't think that the Fed, if they have the ability and if they're going to do anything they can, they're going to try and keep the bond market as controlled as they possibly can, because it's not so much, as you and I know, it's not so much the rise that is the problem, it's the rate of change that causes the problem.
Right. So another way I would say it is, you've got all the money on the planet, you know, demanding that the Fed do that.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I always say, you know, if for some reason the Fed looks like the Fed can't do it, then you're going to have a war. In other words, you know, the market's not going to clear by higher interest rates. It's going to clear with some more dramatic event.
Yeah, and that's typically, you know, an event is what it would take to turn this thing around, because it is so big now. Well, let me, you know, I don't know how well versed your listeners are in the Fed, but can I just spend a few minutes going over what?
Absolutely, please do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, for some people it's going to be really boring, but, you know, really the most effective tool that the Fed has, and the one that it uses the most, is the buying and selling of the government securities in the open markets, and that's their open market operations. So what they do is they buy securities when they want to increase the flow of money and credits, and then they sell securities when they want to reduce that flow. So here's a simple view of how that works. The Fed purchases securities from a bank, and it pays for the securities by adding a credit to the bank's reserves for the amount that they purchase, right? The bank then has to keep a percentage of that in reserve, but they then lend out that excess difference. And, of course, this increases the amount of money in the system, and it, in general, lowers the federal fund rate, which is, you know, the rates that are the short-term rates between the banks. And so under most conditions, you know, this ultimately has a really positive effect on the economy, because it increases businesses and consumer spending, because the banks, one, have more money to lend, and interest rates are lowered, and then the consumers and the businesses find it cheaper to borrow the money. Now, just the opposite is true when they want to decrease the money supply. They sell securities. And what happens is that transaction deducts the purchase amount from a bank's reserves, obviously, and it reduces the amount of money the bank has to lend, and it increases Fed funds rate, and ultimately this slows down the economy. And it does so by decreasing the amount of money the banks have to loan, and it forces higher interest rates, and therefore it slows consumer and business spending. So that's ultimately what they've had in their arsenal in the past to be able to control and influence interest rates. And those were always on the short end, because they really had no effect on the long end, so they would always just monitor the short end. But since 2009, what we have is that they've been using that, but then they embarked on that program that we all know, or we should know, it's called quantitative easing. And what this involved was the Fed was buying longer-term fixed income securities on the open market, and in an effort to try and manage the long end of the interest rate curve. Up until January this year, the Fed was purchasing $85 billion, which is ultimately almost $1 trillion a year, of these fixed income securities in total. And about half of that was in mortgage-backed securities, and the other half was in U.S. Treasuries. So ultimately, this had the effect of putting a cap on long-term interest rates. It didn't mean that they didn't vacillate them down, but depending upon when they bought them and how much they bought, that would help control and keep the longer-term interest rates under control. So one, you know, it really had kind of twofold effect. One, it injected clean money into the balance sheets of the banks, you know, in exchange for this higher risk debt that the banks were giving them for the clean dollars, and it transferred that onto the balance sheet of the feds, and therefore it transferred that risk onto the backs of, you know, from the banks onto the backs of the taxpayers.
Right.
So here's the Fed. You know, this is why ultimately I feel, you know, they're the big, while we're looking at interest rates, ultimately it's the Fed that we're really wanting to monitor, because they're clearly controlling, they have the ability to control short-term interest rates, and they're doing everything they can to keep the long-term rate moderated.
Right.
So that's my quick synopsis on the Fed. I wanted to quick touch on, I don't know how many of the listeners are aware of the bond yield curve and how that works.
Go.
Okay. So the yield curve is a way to look at interest rates across different maturities. So when the longer term yields are much, much higher than the shorter term yields, the curve is said to be steep and the curve slopes upwards. So as longer term yields fall or shorter term yields rise, the curve tends to start to flatten, and that's course obviously called flattening. And then obviously when the longer term bonds are yielding less than shorter term yield or shorter term maturities securities, the yield curve is said to be inverted because it slopes downward. So, you know, why does this all matter? Ultimately, because the yield curve has been a really, really good indicator of economic growth in the past. So over the past 40 years, an inverted yield curve, that's the one that's pointed down, has preceded every single recession, while a steep yield curve tends to precede periods of growth. So again, if the Fed can control both the long and the short ends of the curve, you can see that they can help dictate the environment that is either negative or positive for the economy.
Right.
So take a look at chart number 10, which is today's yield chart. So you can see that, you know, pretty clear that the yield curve today is sloping up, and as such, that's considered to be steep. And if long-term, we're talking about the potential of long-term interest rates rising, so if they continue to creep up or they slightly decline, but the short-term rates remain low. Now remember, the Fed has said they will not consider raising short-term rates until 2016,
right,
2 years from now at the soonest. So this curve will continue to be steep and therefore continue to be a positive setup for ongoing economic growth.
Right.
Now,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say this, is that the one downside is that, you know, we're talking about, you know, the positive, still a positive setup, even if bond rates rise slightly. But, you know, the potential downside, of course, is that it could impact the housing recovery. Right?
Yes. Although, you know, last year what was very interesting was that it impacted REITs and real estate, commercial real estate, but it was remarkably, you know, housing really didn't change anywhere near as much as I thought it would. So it was much more impactful on the REITs and real estate than on housing.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, there was almost, and I'm going from memory here, but it was almost a divergence, because REITs did very poorly last year, and I think housing in general did pretty well.
Right. And what I saw in the local markets was it was this 2.0 versus 3.0,
right,
where you have the economy strong. No one cared about interest rates. Relatively, they just thought, okay, well, they're low. They're still low, not as low, but we don't care. Whereas in the 2.0 markets, it made a much bigger difference. So there was kind of a, yeah.
That's true. Well, you know, the thing is that even if housing does slow, you know, lower, what it does do is it provides the backdrop, even, you know, if the one downside is housing, the yield curve being steep provides, one, better growth, and it provides lower deflation potential and losses for alternatives to stocks and bonds in general. But there are other benefits, and one is that, you know, it's really good, not that some of your investors like myself might not care, but this is really positive for banks because they are able to borrow very cheaply and lend at much higher
right.
rates, and so they make the money on the spread, and so they're much more profitable. And in general, when you're looking at, you know, earnings per share growth, you're going to see that in the banks, and the banks are a large portion of the indexes, which is what we report on.
Well, I hate to tell you where they're doing a lot of it. A lot of it is they're not lending it to businesses. They're lending it back to the government. So it's a huge federal credit arbitrage. We saw in the early 90s it was as much as 600 basis points. They're just, you know, taking in deposits or borrowing short and turning around and lending it back to the U.S. government long. And what I said to them is, look, you know, with the Internet, who needs you? No, really. I mean, the Treasury could just, you know, set up its own eBay version of eBay and do it himself. But that's a lot of it has been the federal credit arbitrage.
Well, you know, the other thing that helps potentially, and again, it maybe not in the short term, but higher long-term interest rates can help ease pension liabilities.
Right. So the pension funds have lost tremendously from the drop in yields. So, right. Now, here's the one thing that one of the big questions for me, Chuck, and that comes down to the interest rate swaps. If you look at outstanding, you know, derivatives have exploded since the mid-90s, and a lot of the derivative book outstanding that we know of are interest rate swaps. And I believe that the central banks have been using those, and the big banks as their agents have been using those to help manage interest rates. And the reality is we have never in the history of the world lived through a period of managing a, you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars of interest rate swap book during a period of rising rates.
That's true.
That's
regardless of any kind of rising or lowering rates, think of the last time we had a rising rate environment, and what was the interest rate swap? Were they even in existence? And they were
really
nowhere close to the level of where they are today.
No.
In existence.
Right. So it's not like you can call up and say, oh, well, let's go hire those 100 smart guys. They know how to manage interest rate derivative book during a period of rising interest rates. Nobody knows how to do that. Nobody's done it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that could be one of those exogenous shocks. I keep saying stocks. Shocks.
Right.
Could just come and shock the entire market.
Well, here's what it means. You know, what it means is that the global central banks have something which really does act like a financial nuclear bomb, and they're going to do whatever they have to do to make sure it doesn't explode. And so you could get in these circumstances where literally all the G7 central banks are, you know, absolutely willing on short notice to do something that looks insane to the rest of us because that's what they have to do, and they have no choice but to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
So it seems to me that it will inspire cooperation.
Yeah, one way or another, you have no choice.
Yeah. The other thing I'd like to point out is, and I realized this when I was looking at sort of what the issues that Yellen was facing as the new chairman, you know, Yellen is facing congressional elections this coming November, and then, you know, a presidential election 2 years from now. And the U.S. Congress has repeatedly shown that it doesn't want to balance the budget. It would much rather have the Fed put more debt on its balance sheet and basically put money into the banks so they can buy government securities. So rather than balancing the budget through fiscal means, you're balancing the budget by debasing the currency. And I think, you know, part of it is because the population has generally preferred debasement to fiscal responsibility. But, you know, that's the question. Can we continue to try and solve the problem through monetary policy? Is the day going to come when we have to solve it through fiscal as well? And I think, to me, that's a big question hanging over the markets, and is going to have, could have a dramatic effect one way or the other.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And, you know, that's, how do you measure that, though? Because it all depends on who gets elected and what kind of cooperation
they're
trying.
Right. But it's sort of a big political question. The other thing I wanted to mention is I believe that one of the reasons we could have such extraordinary debasement over the last 10 to 15 years is because you have significant labor deflation globally through, you know, through shifting so much to the emerging market. So by rebalancing the economy globally, you're competing labor globally, and that's caused a lot of labor deflation, particularly in the developed world. And I bring that up because, as you know, I'm quite amazed at the latest cover of The Economist talking about the next wave of automation coming. Because when you have that kind of labor deflation, it keeps a lid on the inflation that would come if consumers had dollars and were spending. And as we see right now, you know, it looks like consumer spending, certainly in the developed worlds may be, or certainly in North America may be, you know, tapped out. And I just think there's a whole nother round of labor deflation coming that will help to keep inflation in check, but will continue to cause the central bankers to be worried about deflation. And we know Yellen is worried about unemployment. So to me, that's another part of the political equation. How are they going to manage that?
I wish we would have talked ahead of time, because I had this great chart that I knew you. I said, you know what? This, if she goes down,
Catherine's going to bring that up.
I'm going to have this chart, and I'm going to be prepared. I got it sitting right in front of me, but I didn't send it to you because I personally wasn't going to talk about it. But maybe I can send it.
Okay, we'll send it in. We'll put it in because it's you know, I think the policymakers. One of the reasons we've seen government, you know, if you look at the explosion coming in sort of Medicare, Social Security, unemployment, food stamps, you know, that increase in government spending is coming from, you know, is the thing hitting the federal balance sheet that's the result of the labor deflation that's been helping corporate earnings.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things are cycling around and we've been pushing them off. And I have a big question mark about how in the world is this going to get handled over the next couple of years. And what's interesting is The Economist is basically saying government is not dealing with this and it's coming and we better deal with this or, you know, there are very big problems ahead. And, you know, I hate to agree with The Economist again, but I think they're right. So to me, that's another political question mark that hangs over this when I look at the bond market, because you know, the bond market has just been the little engine that could, that's been financing more and more food stamps, more and more food stamps, more and more food stamps. Well, how are we going to keep doing that? I don't know. Big question mark.
Yeah. Let me go back and finish this real quickly with regards to what effect lower interest rates, or excuse me, higher interest rates can have. You know, besides having easing pension liabilities, we also have companies that hold large cash stockpiles, and we've heard a lot about, you know, that existing pile. They're able to earn better returns on them because while they're sitting in cash and not using them to, you know, invest in further growth. The other thing is take a look at, you know, what we were just talking about on chart number 11 here, which is shows shareholder return, which is a combination of share price plus dividends plus share buyback. And then what you see is that there's an inverse relationship, which is exactly what you would think. It kind of bears out what we were just talking about. Since 1998, you have interest rates, and that's using the 20 or 10-year treasury there, have been falling, and shareholder return has actually been rising. So what we have is the relationship is inversely related.
And this chart, to me, this chart says it all, because if the day should come when someone can lock in a 5% yield on a 10-year treasury, they're going to say, you know, I don't want to know from any of this risk. Let me just lock in my 5%. I'm happy with that. You know, get me out of the stock market. Or, you know, or they're really going to say, if I can get a 5% on a municipal in my state, then I'm just going to lock that up and I'm out of the risk business.
sorry for laughing. I actually go into that five, and you happen to pick the 5% level, which I'll hear maybe a little bit down, but you happen to pinpoint it exactly. So with that as a backdrop, what I think is interesting is, you and I spend a lot of time looking at these things, which are, the intermarket analysis of how bonds and stocks interact together, right? So it's always interesting to see what happens. And so, like all relationships of investment types, nothing's consistent. But in general, you can say that there's a negative correlation between interest rates and the stock market. So meaning when interest rates fall, bond prices rise, the stock market rises, and when interest rates rise, the stock market falls. And there are two main reasons why this happens. Not always, but there's, the main reasons are because as rates fall, the potential for higher stock returns look a lot more attractive when compared to those being offered by bonds, right? So investors are willing to take their risk of their investment capital and put it in the stock market. And as rates continue to fall and investors add more money to the stock market, the law of supply and demand eventually kicks in and, of course, continues to push stock prices higher and higher. Ooh, kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? And more buyers, and it continues to push up the stock market until eventually you run out of buyers because there's, all the people that are interested in moving their money from bonds have done that already. So the other reason is due to implication for lower rates is on the broader economy. From an investor standpoint, interest rates are the amount you earn. But from the borrower side, it's really just the opposite. It represents the amount you have to pay. So when companies and individuals can borrow more cheaply, obviously, they tend to be more willing to spend. We talked about that before. And consumers are more willing to buy those big ticket items, such as cars and homes. And just as importantly, the businesses are willing to borrow more money to finance their operations. So all of this activity really generates a positive outlook for both the economy and the stock market returns. So take a look at chart number 12. And this is where I've flipped them here. What I have is the 30-year Treasury yield and against the S&P 500. And so what you have is in orange there is the S&P 500, and the 30-year yield is within that channel in blue. So what this shows is, we were talking about the inconsistency of the relationship. We talked about a general negative correlation, but there's also times when both stocks and interest rates go up in value at the same time.
Right.
And, why is that? Mostly this happens because there's too much liquidity, too much money chasing too few investments. And so a good example of this is when stock markets are topping, and really you can see this happen in both 2000 and 2007. And those, what happened after that. It led to the major declines in the stock market. So as interest rates...
Well, what's remarkable is this is happening at the same time when you look at surveys of investors. A lot of investors are sitting on a huge amount of cash. In other words, there are still plenty of big cash positions. We have... we have the banks in Europe, the European Central Bank, talking about whether they should charge negative deposit rates. And you have banks saying they're going to charge negative deposits on international, because, people are sitting on big, big cash positions. So.
Yeah, I think that this is the most least trusted bull market that we've ever been in. So I think that there's continues to be that cash on the sidelines.
Right. Right, but you really impressed upon me the importance of the stock market can handle a rise in interest rates. It can't handle a fast rise.
Right.
It can handle a managed rise. So, if the goal number one of the Fed is to keep rates down, if they can, it's to make sure that if it's a rise, it's a managed rise.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, as interest rates continue to rise, those, people in the stock market who are, more risk averse, they're going to start to shift out of stocks and into bonds, as interest rates rise. And normally when that happens, you start to see that you become in equilibrium where prices can't really go any higher because of the lack of buyers.
Right.
And eventually as that happens, that is what you and I will call a top, because that's what happens in the stock market. And finally, from an intermarket analysis, there are times when both stocks and interest rates fall. And this is usually occurs when investors are in a panic. They rarely go down together at the same time. And, you know, this happens when investors sell everything. And the fourth quarter of 2008 was a really good example of when both, if you take a look at that chart, when both stocks and interest rates fell together. So ultimately what that led to, as we know, is the Fed attempted to increase liquidity by lowering of rates. So again, they tried to manipulate and get in and control the rates so that we can stop the fall. So I want to go over real quickly, and I don't think you knew I was going to talk about this, but you led me right into it, and I appreciate it. While, you know, higher rates are typically bad for, you know, current bondholders because they drive bond prices down. You know, there's a study that was done by LPL Financial that shows the relationship over history of the 10-year treasury notes and stock prices. And what they found, just in summary, what they found is that a 5%, and you hit it right on the nose, is that line in the sand where it becomes negative for stocks. And, you know, and as you said, I think so succinctly, was the fact that investors have an alternative. They say, do I want a 5% guaranteed return, if you want to call it a guarantee from a municipality or a treasury or whatever, with no volatility, or do I want to be in the stock market and maybe beat it, but have to live with you know, the ups and downs?
Right. And the other thing, it's simple. You know, it's very easy to understand a treasury bond,
yes,
whereas to understand the nature of, you know, different parts of the economy or a particular company or stock can be very complex.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so, you know, people have other things to do, spending their time investing, so what they'll do is they'll tend to gravitate to those things that are the simplest and, you know, the easiest to manage too.
Right.
So in general, you know, I think that from all the stuff we've discussed, it's the bond prices and yields that we watch, but in reality it's the Fed that dictates their movements. And so, you know, that's why you and I follow them so closely, unfortunately. It's what, unfortunately, we're not watching the market, we're watching the Fed. So regardless of which side of the Fed, you know, you're on, whether they're going to exit their stimulus plan or not, you know, they really only have three choices. They can either continue to keep bond yields low, they can do what they can to let bond yields rise, but they want to do it in a controlled manner so that it doesn't disrupt other markets. Or the final thing is, I don't think that they're going to have the control of this, but, you know, there's either an event or there's a scenario that the market might decide that rates need to climb much higher than the Fed wants them to, and then they're going to move very quickly, and that will have negative implications.
Right. The more intervention you have, the less resilience you have, the less resilience you have, the more you need intervention.
Yes.
You know, and around we go. That's how we end up with such a centralized system.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. And the fact of how big of a, you know, because the bond market is so big now, the effect of trying to control that bond market, it takes more and more and more piles of money.
Right.
So ultimately,
it's funny. One of the things I
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
One of the things I try and impress on people is when Congress is negotiating the federal budget, they're not negotiating spending. Because all that spending is basically a series of cash flows that lever up the stock, bond, and derivative market. So they're whipping around the outstanding market valuations and market caps of all those securities. And so there's a very delicate negotiation between all the money in the planet and the cash flows that they're creating to keep them. You know, it's like keeping a volleyball up. And everybody starts screaming if they think you're going to let their volleyball fall. It's pretty interesting.
Well, you know, I'm ultimately, out of those three scenarios, the first two can be reasonably positive for stocks going forward, up until you get some line in the sand of maybe that 5% level. I don't know if that 5% level is going to hold today because, gosh, how long has it been since we've been at 5% and an investor has been able to see a 5% return on a 10-year treasury. But
right.
That being said, I think two of those still could help support. The first two options or scenarios that play out could be positive for stocks. I think what we have to be concerned about is, you know, either the market or the Fed deciding that they want this to change quickly. So,
right. So it's really, you know, it's really, I think of both commodities and equities as the tail, and the,
yeah,
you know, the head of the dog is wagging them.
Absolutely.
And right.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to mention a couple other things. One of the points you brought up that really has been reverberating throughout my cosmology ever since you said it was the fact that so few people outside of the United States own equities.
Yeah.
You know, in Europe, it's really, or in Japan, it's really an institutional investment. It's not a retail investment. And we are going through a very long-term, unprecedented growth of a middle class in the emerging markets. And I think the big question is, you know, will that group be equity investors or not? I put up, I sent it to you, a recent survey that was very small, so I think far from representative, but asking mobile phone users who were using their phone for financial transactions in the emerging markets, which they trusted more, their bank, their local property market, or the stock market, or virtual currencies. And they all said their bank, but in most countries, after their bank, it was virtual currencies before the local property market, and then the stock market came in way dead last. Well, you know, if something should happen that would cause the emerging middle class to become equity investors globally, you know, then I think we could see a shift. And I, for one, think about this a lot because I don't see politically how you manage a global economy if everybody's invested in debt instead of equity. I mean, equity is a way to build cooperation, you know, globally over the long term. So to me, we're going to have to get in an equity model somehow. And, you know, the question is, are we going to do it nice or rough?
Yeah, exactly, Tina.
Right. So, well, the way to get there rough is, you know, everybody goes bankrupt, you mark all the debt down, and you have a mess. You know, and after the war is over, you know, everybody clears the deck and says, okay, well, I guess we're going to have to, you know, get the economy being productive again. So, I'm hopeful that, well, let me just mention one other thing, because the other thing that really, you know, Templeton said, you know, don't believe the three words, it's different this time. But the one thing that is different is for the first time since 2011, we've had 500 million people get on the internet through smartphones or tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no doubt that you have the payment systems and more financial transactions in all markets moving onto this platform.
Yeah.
And that's very new. I mean, we've got 1.2, 1.3 billion people. 70% of all the, you know, people who relate to financial transactions globally online, ready to do transactions through their phones. So what is that going to do? What's that going to mean? I don't think anybody knows, but I think it's very new.
Yeah, the one thing, you know, I go back to your, you know, the lack of emerging market equity investors, and I think back, is that a cultural thing like Japan, you know, because Japan is really more debt oriented, their investors tend to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think you bring up another thing, which was that internet, which is, even if it is, you know, cultural, if anything can change it, it can be the internet,
right,
and the ability of this technology to be able to change things. Because it's, I think that, you know, using Japan, they're so entrenched at the way they are, but the emerging markets are so ahead in terms of what they're willing to accept and to be able to take into consideration. I think that the possibility of them changing, if it is a cultural thing, is very, very high. I don't know whether it'll happen, but I do think that there is, you know, we're in an environment that it could happen.
Well, I, you know, the creative destruction that can occur from new technology when you have that many people, you and I talk a lot about using apps to re-engineer healthcare and other things. When you have that kind of creative destruction going on, you're going to see big changes in the underlying economy. And even though the Fed and the central banks have tremendous power, you know, those changes are going to make a difference over time. So to me, that the economy can be very divergent in ways that we don't, you know, I don't think we understand. So I, on one hand, they're going to be trying to make it look like the Stairway to Heaven, I think, underneath the carpet. Some pretty creative, yeah, there's some pretty creative things that are going to go on and very divergent. So, you know, there's some of us who would say, listen, if I can get 5%, I don't want to think about it. And there are other of us who'd like to say, you know, looking under the carpet, I think I can make a lot of money. So there will be equity and fixed income investors, come what may.
Well, just to wrap this up, I did want to touch on one last thing, because we talked about, you know, bonds being the, you know, the 900-pound gorilla. There's one more large 900-pound animal in the equity party room, and it's an elephant. And to me, this is one thing we have to be really, really concerned about, because we kind of summarized what bonds have an effect on with regards to corporations, and that's corporate profits.
Right. Right.
So take a look at chart number 13. It's my last chart, I promise. I'll quit here after this.
Okay.
This is a chart of corporate after-tax profits as a percentage of GDP. So that's in blue. And then subsequent four-year annual profit growth in red. So really what it tries to do is it tries to plot, you know, what corporate profits do and then the subsequent returns that you would see on those equities. So real simply put, you know, to summarize this thing is that high profits over GDP or high profits as a percentage of GDP are associated with weak subsequent profit growth. Right?
Right.
So the higher you have on your beyond the mean, what you have is you have a reversion to the mean here. And it's pretty interesting because the mean there is about 6%. And what you see is that every single time that you get somewhere stretched, you know, it's usually 2%, you've had a mean reversion and it snaps back and it falls back down. And each time you've had that snap back, what you've seen is, you know, a real decline in corporate earnings. And so look at where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
We had that massive growth in just beyond the 8% level, which is 2% above the mean in 2005-06 area. And then we had the snapback in 2008-09. And look at where we are today. We're at unprecedented levels.
Right. And if you look at the numbers on dividend payouts and then you add the buybacks,
yeah,
you know, the corporations are paying out about 80 to 90%
yep.
of their profits. They're not reinvesting. They are paying out.
Right.
So
how much more can that, you know, continue to expand?
Well, if you look at those, if you just look at the percentage numbers, what you're saying is these corporations don't think they have any, you know, basically they're re-engineering their labor down and then they're re-engineering their financial side of their balance sheet, but they, it's as though they don't believe they have any fundamental economic opportunities. Now, with the S&P this high, I was assuming that, you know, mergers and acquisitions would kick up with companies in the developed world trying to buy as many in the emerging markets as they could.
And we have
that. No, what's interesting is one of the leading indicators I try and watch is financial institution staffing. So when the investment banks, as we've seen at the end of the fourth quarter, are laying off enormous number of people in their fixed income divisions, what you can tell is, and this is partly the Dodd-Frank bill, you know, the party in fixed income is over. So they're getting ready for leaner times on the fixed income side. Now, what you have is indications that they're expecting more profits and IPOs and mergers, but we have yet to really see that, you know, develop. But if they don't make the money back on the equity side, then you're going to have a real, you know, a real big question mark in the financial sector. So they're clearly not planning on doing it in the fixed income side. So the question is, can they shift it to the equity? And that's going to be IPOs and mergers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to have to make it up somewhere.
Right.
Well, just to close this thing out, because, you know, I tend to analyze these things and whenever I can find a way to squeeze in some math here, I have. What, you know, right now we're 80% over the historical norm average.
Right.
And that is, of course, as you can see on this chart, is unprecedented. But what it's telling us, and this is the part that bothers me the most, is that if history is any guide and you do get a snap back to even the mean, what you're expecting going forward, this isn't just an estimate, is that it says that a 22% annualized, this is 22% annualized contraction in profits over the next coming 4 years is expected. Now, it's calculated, and I think what can be expected is something more like a high single digits or low double digits. But regardless of the exact amount, what it's telling us is that you should expect a reversion of mean back to normal levels of profits. And as we know, stock prices are, you know, part of the reason why stocks rise or fall is dictated by the level of profits. And so because of this, you know, we kind of have to ask ourselves, you know, if the Fed continues to unwind, going back to the Fed and profits, combining them all together, if the Fed continues to unwind the QE, which they have begun this month, you know, are the profits going to continue to rise, or are they going to mean revert? And the second thing is if profits can't continue, how are the markets, in this case the stock market, going to react to it?
So if we see the PEs, if the PEs have gone up this much, yes, it's hard to imagine that higher than normal PEs would remain if earnings snap back to the median.
Absolutely, and that's what you got to be concerned with. But you brought up some really good points of why it could potentially happen. And, you know, at some point in time, the expansion of PEs can continue as long as the fewer the alternatives you have. Remember, the bond market is twice the size, so all it takes is a small amount of money moving out of bonds that could fill that void of earnings and expand PDE.
So I think part of what the story is going to be, and I don't know what it's going to look like in terms of price and levels, is just divergence. You know, I think one of the most important charts you showed tonight was, you know, yes, the U.S. market was up strongly, but when you look, you know, when you dig inside and you look, you have many sectors that had terrible years.
Yeah.
So it was very unevenly distributed. And I think, you know, that's what I see driving around the country as well. In the economy, you have some places that are booming and other places that are in a Great Depression. And, you know, there's extraordinary divergence. And I think that's what I continue to expect is divergence.
Yeah. So in that kind of environment, it takes, I'll just call it a unique ability to understand and recognize those areas that are strengths, you know, that have strength and those that don't. And so one has to be very, very careful. So, for example, if you had invested a good portion of your money in REITs last year, you would have done very poorly versus healthcare. So I'm just using that as an example. We're getting that divergence, you know, not only within regions of the world, but also within a single region like the United States. So capitalizing on and making profits on that is something that makes it a real challenge.
Right. So if you were in utilities in North America, you lost 16%. If you were in Venezuela, you're up 480%.
Exactly. Although you're
go figure.
500%.
Right. Well, Chuck, it's been great. This has always been, it's fascinating to, you know, it's fascinating to understand how much we have to be nervous about.
I really did want to present a positive thing, but I think we have to, looking at where we are in today's market, we do have to be objective and say, you know, what if, and if something happens, how am I going to react? So I don't anticipate, you know, anything negative, but we also have to not be so ignorant to the fact and stick our head in the sand that this thing can continue on forever.
Well, right. And I think in everything, again, the intervention makes for many, you know, many more possible scenarios going forward. Yep. And we have to be able to envision, no matter which scenario it is, we have to be able to find the pathway and the opportunity in that scenario.
Yep.
Because these things are going to happen. It's going to be, you know, yes, this year was Stairway to Heaven, but it can be rock and roll at any time.
Absolutely.
For those of us who were in precious metals, it was rock and roll until we got over the Stairway to Heaven. Okay, well, I can't thank you enough. We will have all these charts integrated into the audio, so by the time the Solaria Report subscribers watch, I hope you're watching the Audio than has all of Chuck's wonderful charts. So, Chuck, have a wonderful quarter, and we'll have you back in the Solaria Report for the second quarter equity overview.
Thanks, Catherine. Look forward to it. Talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.